It's Tuesday, January 4, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Many Christians, especially those in the safety of the West, have believed for some time that martyrdom is simply an ancient part of Christian history. But the headlines we're seeing in the newspapers and in the media around the world remind us that that is anything but the case. Three particular cases deserve our attention. First of all, in Egypt, where the Saints Church in Alexandria was bombed on the first day of this year, killing over 20 people and injuring another 100. Now, what we're looking at in Egypt is a sectarian crisis that involves not just a small number of Christians, but the nearly 10 million Christians in Egypt that make up approximately one-eighth of the population of that nation. That nation, of course, is the largest Arab population of any nation in the world. Now, what's been going on in Egypt for a number of years is the rise of Islamic extremism and a tide of anti-Christian prejudice that has now turned viral, terroristic, and murderous. About a year ago in Nag Hammadi, there was a similar attack by gunmen that killed 7 people. Now 21 persons are dead in Alexandria, and Christians in Egypt are beginning to wonder if they all wear targets on their back simply for identifying with Jesus Christ. In Iraq, as we discussed just before the end of the year, there is a virtual evacuation of Christians from that land, numbering only about 3 million at any high point. Roughly one half of all of Iraq's Christians have already fled, given repeated bombings, shootings, terroristic attacks, and increasing threats just for being a Christian in that nation. And then in the same region, if you go to Pakistan, rioters went in the streets last week complaining that the nation might actually reconsider the draconian blasphemy laws, which had first been put in place back in the 1970s. Now remember that these blasphemy laws serve one central purpose. Muslim populations not only in Pakistan, but around the world, and increasingly in the circles of the United Nations, are pushing for these blasphemy laws as a way of criminalizing any supposed slander or blasphemy that speaks with disrespect of a religion. Now, even to Christians, this might at first sound like a good idea, but it's anything but. Because, of course, if you are bearing testimony to the gospel of Jesus Christ, you are speaking contrary to Islam. That is considered in Islamic countries a crime, a slander against Islam. These blasphemy laws are the enemy of religious liberty, and they are means whereby Christians are persecuted, prosecuted, and now we know even worse. At my website this morning, I published an article entitled Martyrs in a Modern World, dealing with these issues and providing links to ongoing coverage. A story emerged over the New Year's holiday that first appeared to be perhaps a peripheral, rather salacious news account, but now appears to be something far greater. On Monday, Navy officials in the Pentagon admitted that they face a crisis on the USS Enterprise, a nuclear aircraft carrier with approximately 6,000 naval personnel. The story comes down to this. The captain of the ship, Captain Owen Honors, back when he was the executive officer of the ship, and that amounts to any time previous to this May, had made a series of videos that were shown over the ship's public affairs system and were made on government equipment at government expense, which include slurs against gay men, open exhibitions of sexual behavior, and lewd language and actions that would be clearly shocking to the public. The videos were disclosed over the weekend by the Virginian pilot of Norfolk, Virginia, and the news story eventually has reached the point that virtually every major news source has had to deal with it. Captain Honors was the ship's executive officer, thus second in command, when he made, and not only made, but starred in the videos. He declined a request for comment to the New York Times on Monday. And once again, the videos were made back in 2006 and 2007. One of the big questions is how no one brought this to light. After all, we're talking about videos that were seen by approximately 6,000 persons. This was when Captain Honors was then the executive officer. Where was the commanding officer, the captain of the ship at that time? And for that matter, where was the admiral in command of the fleet? There should have been a good amount of awareness about what was going on here. The United States military has a very central place in our society. A place of respect, and a place of dignity. The military depends upon that. And thus, the entire military faces a crisis when a breakdown of command and control, of basic decorum and decency like this, is made so public. I will not go into detail about these videos. Suffice it to say that the media accounts are enough to indicate that this is nothing that should take place in terms of the command structure of the United States military, and especially by one who is now a captain in an exalted status of a major nuclear aircraft carrier. The Navy says that Captain Anders may be relieved of command while the investigation is ongoing. Let's hope this investigation comes to a rather speedy and conclusive end. On the liberal side of the political equation, there are several interesting arguments that are ongoing. One has to do with the objectivity of moral claims. Renee Loth, writing in the Boston Globe earlier in December, wrote a column entitled "Human Rights Are Absolute." Now, in her column, she was making a familiar argument. She argued that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written at the United Nations in 1948, should be absolutely and objectively applied across all cultures, in all situations, throughout time. In other words, local situations and circumstances shouldn't matter. There must be no relativizing of this Declaration of Human Rights. Now, when you look at this, that appears to be basically where most persons taking an objective moral stance would stand. But it also is something that, upon reflection, turns out not to be exactly the way the world works. Those who led in the formulation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights back in the late 1940s, in the wake of the atrocities of the Second World War, certainly intended that the statement would be applied objectively, where at least there was the military will and the might to make it happen. Now, what makes Renee Loth's column so interesting is a response that came from Javier Casey, who wrote a letter to the editor insisting that there can be no absolutes, including absolutes of human rights. Mr. Casey's point is that the establishment of an objective morality, of objective moral claims, requires some enforcement. And he sees that enforcement, the use of force in any circumstance, as a greater wrong than abrogations of human rights. This is one of the most interesting arguments on the philosophical and moral left. It is one of those unsolved and perhaps unsolvable issues that is continually a matter of academic and political debate. But, interestingly enough, over the period of the last half century and more, the United States, following a basic attitude of realpolitik, or a method of dealing with political realism, has sought to temper the understanding of these absolute rights with the resistance of absolute reality. Over the past several years, I've had a few public confrontations with former President Jimmy Carter. All of these have been in print, and they've been over matters of theology, not matters of politics. I want to refer to a new article that is published at Salon.com and an issue that's getting a good deal of attention. And I want to draw attention to a war in which President Carter is involved, and one in which all persons must hope he will win. It has to do with his fight through the Carter Center against the guinea worm disease. Back in the 1950s, approximately 50 million people around the world were afflicted by this horrible disease, in which victims are taken over by 3-foot predaceous worms that eventually cause grave disease before painfully exiting the body. The realities of this disease are almost as if it comes from science fiction. Mr. Carter, now 86 years old, has set his center on seeking to eradicate the very last cases of this disease. Fewer than 1,700 cases were found this year, isolated to 4 countries, Ethiopia, Ghana, Mali, and Sudan. One of the realities of the politics of Sudan and the strife in that country is that the Carter Center is finding it difficult to actually get into that nation to do the kind of medical care that could eventually eradicate this disease totally. Hats off to President Carter for this one. May his efforts to eradicate this horrible disease be blessed and successful. There's a lot of talk out there, of course, about what to expect in the coming year. Ed Rogers, writing at the Washington Post, raised something that certainly caught my attention. He's a former Republican strategist and one who has a keen eye on America's political pulse. Here's one of the issues that he raises. Will Americans, especially in states such as California, New York, and Illinois, faced with inevitable and draconian budget cuts, take to the streets as protesters have in Paris, London, Rome, and in places like Portugal as well? It's an interesting question. It sounds odd to think that Americans might do this, but a look at American history will tell us that it has happened in the past. The kind of pressures that have led to these protests in nations such as England and France and Italy are likely to come to at least some states in the United States. When it comes to the shortfalls of state budgets, having to do not only with issues of employment, but also of pensions and ongoing social programs. We'll be watching this one carefully. I found it interesting that the Washington Post asked the question, and that Mr. Rogers was so quick to raise this possibility. Now, here's a news story that should certainly have our attention. The Detroit Free Press reports that a man in that state now faces 5 years in prison for reading his wife's email. Now, reading from the account, what we learn is that this man was in the process of divorcing his wife. He applied for emergency custody of his wife's young son when he gained from email messages the fact that she was having an affair with her ex-husband, a man who was previously arrested for domestic violence. Now, here's what's going on here that makes it interesting. The wife, or perhaps now even ex-wife, went to the police charging her husband with hacking her email account. It turns out that he is a very proficient computer engineer. The prosecutor of Oakland County, Jessica Cooper, told the Detroit Free Press that she decided to charge Leon Walker because, quote, the guy's a hacker. It was password protected. He had wonderful skills and was highly trained. Then he downloaded them and used them in a very contentious way, end quote. Now, many lawyers in Detroit and throughout Michigan say that the case has absolutely no merit and the prosecution will not stand. But just imagine what this precedent would mean. It would mean that parents, for instance, could be criminally charged for reading the email of their own children, an issue raised not only by the Detroit Free Press, but also by the Washington Post in a subsequent report on the account. Obviously, we'll be watching this one very closely. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information and a wealth of resources, go to albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. And for information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.